Hello, beautiful listeners. This is Jack Hutchcraft. You're listening to the 16th episode of the Human Magic Podcast. How are you doing today? You good? How are you feeling? Okay, cool. Thanks for asking. Oh, thanks for sharing. And thanks for asking. I am also feeling okay today. I feel not too bad. Thank you. Thank you for everyone that donates to the podcast and supports me in that way, and everyone who listens and sends me questions and thoughts. That's really, really important, and really, you know, it really adds to this whole thing because it's a conversation, and I know a lot of questions get raised in these podcasts. So thanks for being a part of the listenership. And if you do want to buy me a coffee or buy me a beer or just say, you know, here's a couple of quid, thanks for a great episode or whatever it is, you can donate. I'll put a link in the description. I'm really excited to introduce my guest today. So this is a woman called Dr. Brandi Scilacce, and she came into my life because she emailed me and we had a conversation a few months ago, and it was about cloning and about a religious group that I was writing about and that I've got to know. And the chat went from cloning to head transplants, and then she's just released a book. So I thought I'd get her on the podcast and talk on air about all the work she does. So she's a medical historian. She's also an author, and she's what gets labeled as an alternative academic. She describes herself as an adventurer at the intersections, and those intersections are literature, history, medicine, and philosophy, and science, I guess. So it's quite deep stuff. We talk about head transplants and the strange world of Dr. Robert White, the guy who transplanted a monkey's head onto another monkey's body, and also tried to do it with humans. And we also talk about cloning and ethics around all of these kind of fringe, quite gruesome scientific, you know, experiments over the years, since the 50s onwards, really. And obviously way before that, but we're talking kind of about Dr. Robert White from the 50s onwards. And we talk about ethics and kind of the soul and who we are and what makes us us. Because, you know, if you move someone's brain out of their head and put it, you know, keep it alive in a jar, you know, is that them? Are they really still there? What defines death? What defines self? Pretty big concepts, but I think you'll really enjoy it. I guess I'll give a trigger warning or a content warning on this, that there is some descriptions of like medical gore, I guess, you know, stuff like animal testing and animal mutilation, really, and some pretty grisly details around that. So if you're squeamish or kind of offended by that kind of thing, then approach with caution. But I think it was a fascinating talk, and yeah, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Brandi now. Dr. Brandi Scilacce. She's a legend. I really enjoyed speaking to her. I'll see you at the end. Hello, Brandi.
Hello, Jack. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing really well, all things considered.
Yeah,
it's strange world we live in.
It is strange. Yeah, I'm somewhat got used to the weirdness. Thank you so much for coming on the Human Magic Podcast. I've been wanting to speak to you more in depth since we first connected, you know, a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
and obviously to tie in with your new book, which it's fascinating, a fascinating subject. But really, to go back to, I mean, who you are and where you're coming from.
Sure.
I read online that you were described as an alternative academic. I don't know if those are your words or somewhere. So, like, what does that mean? And kind of how did you get into, into being sure, an alternative sure. academic or into the into the weirder side of science and psychology and things like that.
I like to think of myself as an adventurer at the intersections of things, but I absconded from academia, you might say. I had been. I have a PhD, and I was a tenure track faculty member at one point here in the United States. And I have been also sort of academic adjacent for a long time. I worked at a medical history museum, which was attached to a university. So technically I was affiliated with that university. I also was managing editor for a medical anthropology journal for 10 years. And I now am editor in chief of the BMJ's medical humanities journal. So I'm still like in the kind of, I don't know, the atmosphere of academia, but I myself jumped ship. And this is quite rare. I think most of the time, if you've got tenure, you're not going to leave. But I just felt like, academe, and there's lots of good reasons for this. So I'm not necessarily saying it's bad, but it is about staying in your lane a little bit. It's about the boxes that you inhabit. And I don't live in the boxes. I live between boxes. You know, I live in that sort of gray interstitial area, which is, you know, science, but kind of humanities, but kind of, you know, sometimes on the fringe of things. And mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by the untold stories that happen at those intersections, because I don't think they get told. I think people tend to focus on the black and the white, when for me, the gray areas are far more interesting. And so I have separately been worked in an English department, a history department. I've had an office in an anthropology department while I worked on the journal. And then now I'm not in any department at all. You know, now I'm a freelance writer who I write books, I write articles, I write for Scientific American. book reviews for Wall Street Journal. So I'm kind of everywhere. I also run the Peculiar Book Club, which is it's like, you know, the Oprah Book Club, but for, you know, Morticia Adams types. and that's kind of my, again, I'm at the intersection of what, six different things. And that's for me what it means to be kind of alt-ac, I guess.
Yes. Okay, cool. So the intersections of what, like history, literature, for even philosophy, right? Because some of that comes into science, yeah. Because the nature of what of the some of the projects that you've worked on, I think, scream philosophy as much as they mm-hmm. do science and ethics as well, of course.
Oh yeah.
So are you from like a science family?
No, I grew up in an underground house in abandoned coal country near a graveyard. My parents do not have college educations. As a matter of fact, I'm one of the few, I think, in my family ever to have gotten a college education, much less a PhD. So, yes, I come from, you know, good blue collar stock, as they say. And I lived in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we had 50 acres. We were in the middle of like 40,000 acres of public hunting, kind of abandoned coal mining land. You know, it's to say it's public land. Yeah, it's public land with like sinkholes and mines in it. But yeah, so that's where I grew up. You know, sort of place where you drive an hour to watch a movie if you want to like find civilization. So no, I did not. But I came from a family in which medicine was highly involved, but from the other side. Lots of illness in my family, lots of early death in my family. And both my parents, though still living, suffer with my mother has had cancer five, six times, repeated surgeries. You know, she comes out of remission, and my father has just had his fourth heart attack. I mean, there's so many you lose count, and just had open heart surgery this year for a blocked left in artery descending. So, you know, I got used to science and medicine early in life because bad things kept happening to my family. And being in the United States, getting medical insurance is very difficult, and it bankrupted my family, actually. Oh, sure. So, so I spent, you know, I remember as a young child, a very formative experience of waking up in the middle of the night and creeping to my parents' door to make sure they were both still breathing. And worrying at, I was probably 12 maybe, that I might have to somehow raise my brother, and how are we going to live, and worried about money and worried about things like that. So, this was we were a middle-class family to start with, but you know, you can be brought to the brink of ruin by medical and science. And as a child, I think I felt really powerless. And so one of the ways I sought to gain back some control of these things was through reading. So I read, you know, I was such a voracious reader, and you know, this is me sitting on tombstones at the nearby graveyard reading about the Black Plague, right? So it's not surprising that I took a somewhat gothic turn. Exactly. We thought our hilltop was haunted. My brother thought he, I mean, like, all kinds of strange things happen when you're in the middle of nowhere and there's no humans around. You know, I think it forces you to do a lot of very private, personal, solo reflection on things, this kind of, these kind of early experiences. So that was the push, to be honest. I as much as I love fiction, and I do, and I taught fiction, I taught Gothic literature. One of the things that I read the most of is nonfiction, particularly science. I want to read nonfiction that blows my mind.
Yes. And it just sounds like you write about nonfiction that blows your mind as well. Well, blew my mind. Okay. That sounds really heavy. like going through, you know, I mean, your parents look after you, right? And then being feeling helpless to look after them at an early age must not have been easy.
I suppose if you had a point of comparison, but I didn't really, you know. So that was just what life was. You always think what happens in your house is just how things are.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you mentioned last time we spoke, and I'll get on to why we spoke in the first place. You mentioned that you've got a really rare condition, if I can call it that, with the temporal lobe, in which was also partly why you were started to get interested in the perhaps more murkier and unexplained areas of science and neuroscience. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
I am neurologically interesting. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
My neurologist once asked me to donate my brain to science, which I think is some sort of weird compliment from a neurologist, but not something you want to hear.
Yeah, of course.
Particularly when they're quite a bit older than you are, and you're like, you're not going to get a look at it, right? So it's funny how sometimes you don't realize that something's always been with you until much later, because we have a tendency when we're young to assume everyone's experiences are common. So I have a somewhat unusual beginning in life as well. And I'm not actually diagnosed as neurodivergent, but I think it's probably fair to say I am. I learned to talk in sentences by the time I was 8 months old. And I also could walk at that time as well. So a lot of people assumed that I might have been a little person. They took my diminutive size and my articulate, you know, my ability to articulate to be that I was actually much older, but just very, very small, which wasn't the case.
Okay.
But there were other things that were kind of unusual about me as a child. I couldn't stand to be held. I didn't like to be touched. I was horribly, horrendously claustrophobic. Couldn't even go into like a garage space. There always had to be windows. There was a whole lot of little weird things about me that I was being raised by my mother and grandparents at the time. And so they were just kind of like, you know, good hillbilly stock. You're like, oh, she's a bit peculiar, but it's okay. So, you know, that was just how we operate. I wasn't sent for tests or anything like that. And in fact, it wasn't until my brother came along that my mom thought something might be wrong with him. And it turned out, I was just the weird one. Yeah. Wow. Well, because, you know, he didn't learn to talk until he was two. And she was like, he doesn't talk yet. The doctors were like, yeah, that's good. Fine. So to begin with, I give that as background because I didn't realize anything was particularly unusual about any of that. But by the time I got to be in college, when there was a lot of stress, I was working full time, well, almost full time, as well as going to college full time. And I was supporting myself and all these other things, which meant I wasn't sleeping very much. Mm-hmm. And I started having peculiar episodes, which it's hard to explain exactly. It usually started with a kind of visual disturbance. And later they suspected it might be in the realm of epilepsy of some kind, because they were sort of like auras, and I would get dysgraphic disorder and aphasia, meaning language suddenly stopped making sense. And it's really hard to think if you don't have words. And recalling that I had words since I was 8 months old, this was quite a disruptive experience. So I would suddenly have trouble. Like it was like being frozen inside yourself because I was awake and I was aware, and I normally looked like nothing really was going on.
Yeah.
But I'd have these, it might be as short as a minute, but to me it felt eternal, where I couldn't communicate. And I would just sit there going, things wrong, things bad.
Wow.
And as those got worse, as the gaps got longer, other particularly unusual things started to happen. So you can call them hallucinations, but it isn't quite that. It's that I had a neurologist explain it this way, and I apologize because this is a very unscientific, but for me as a college student, it was very helpful. He's like, your brain has a gap. It doesn't like gaps. So it's throwing stuff in there to like bridge those blank spaces. And what would happen is things I'd seen earlier in the day, for instance, would suddenly overlap with the things I was seeing in the moment. And deja vu works this way a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So deja vu is actually your brain processing the same thing twice, but so fast that you don't notice it twice. You just think you're remembering it.
Okay.
And I would have long stretches of deja vu. I once had deja vu all day. It was really annoying. You're so bored by the end. It's like Groundhog Day. But what was happening is those gaps were too big. So my brain was not just processing the last, say, 10 microseconds. It was also processing stuff from earlier in the afternoon. So while I was in college, I'd gone to a drawing class, and we're drawing cows in a field. I don't know why, but that's what we were doing. I went back to my dorm room later, and I turned around and I saw my dorm room, my walls, my couch, my phone, and a field and cows. And I thought, okay,
whoa.
One of those isn't correct. I can't be in both of these places, but you don't know which one. And in that moment, it's hard to tell which one's wrong. So you're I might be in the field and I'm hallucinating my dorm room, or I might be in the dorm room and I'm hallucinating the field, and you're not sure. And so it's a very disruptive thing. And I was thinking, do I have schizophrenia? Like, I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't, none of that made any sense. And anyone I talked to about it was like, no, I've never heard that before. So that makes you really interested in brains suddenly when this kind of thing's happening to you. And neurologists are going, don't know, sounds interesting.
And it's like a vivid overlay, or is it like your room is in the field kind of thing?
So I have a very visual mind. I have a near photographic memory, not exactly photographic, but pretty close. So what I saw might not have been what other people would see, but for me, the vividness was, it looked like my sofa was sitting in a field of cows.
God, wow.
But the painting above my sofa was still hanging there. There just wasn't a wall. So, you're sort of seeing both things, and they melded together. So what the neurologist was most surprised by in my case is the clarity of that combination, that that my brain's means of processing didn't do it as a sort of like weird mashup where you're like, whoa, scrambled eggs. It did it as a kind of like, all right, well, we'll hang this painting here.
It's like a collage.
Right. It really created a somewhat artistic rendering of the thing that was going on in my brain, which that is, I guess, what they thought was pretty. It's not that these things don't happen to other people. They do. But given my already somewhat unusual neurological processing, this is what the outcome was. And it was actually quite, I was beautifully staged. I don't know who is the producer in my brain, but it was really nicely done. Good set design.
Sounds quite surrealist. like a couch in the field. I can see it as a painting when you describe it.
Right.
Do you still get them now?
No. So, no, because I know how to, I've finally over time learned what the signs that they're coming on are. And the solution for me tends to be to de-stress and to make sure I'm sleeping. Because my brain sort of goes, okay, no, it's cool. We got this most of the time. But what the feeling is like for me, and so this is why I became fascinated by brains. And I've written papers about temporal lobe epilepsy and other kinds of things. By the way, they're not really sure that that's what I have. They know it's something to do with temporal lobes because of the kind of experiences, but they're not exactly sure. They don't really think it's epilepsy. It could be related to migraine. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I became fascinated. I wrote a lot of papers about epilepsy, about migraine, I find that. But what I also found interesting was how much the experiences of people suffering those conditions mimic early explanations of the Gothic. So Anne Radcliffe, who is 18th century early writer of Gothic fiction, kind of inaugurated the genre. Mm-hmm. And she'd had the people having dreamy mental states and, you know, possible supernatural in these weird moments and people being dissociated from others and isolated in castles and all this kind of stuff. That the characters, the heroines that she writes, they process this in a way that reminded me of a kind of escalating absence seizures leading to dreamy mental states and et cetera. So I wrote quite an extensive paper about how these things overlap and almost to the point that it is possible that Anne Radcliffe had maybe temporal lobe epilepsy. I can't prove that, but yeah, it's possible she was using experiences to talk about that. She did at one point live across the way from Bedlam Asylum, so she could also have maybe witnessed it. But, right, okay. you know, but it's this concept that, oh, wow, we literally have created an entire genre of literature about what it's like to feel disconnected, dissociated, wrapped in a dreamy mental state where maybe there's reality and maybe there's not. And maybe we don't know what the line between reality and unreality is. And having this condition, and I think this is true of a lot of people who experience auras, it feels the same. Part of you feels like maybe you're about to, you know, realize that there's truly a multiverse or something. You know, you feel like reality suddenly seems very unreal. And that also spurs my interest. I'm also interested in quantum mechanics for the same reason, because the study of quantum mechanics also makes you go, maybe reality isn't real. So it loosens the edges. And that's probably how I became an intersection hunter, right? Somebody who looks at the edges, because I think that's where a lot of the interesting stuff is happening, just on the periphery of what of our sort of more mundane ways of accepting things tends to be. And if you're someone who has a brain like mine, which I kind of lack pinpoint focus, it means everything for most people, if you're looking at something, you have a focus area that you're really paying attention to. It's not that your eyes aren't seeing everything. It's that your brain is going, we're just going to pay attention to what's in this small circle in the middle here. But I process all the input at all times, coming from everywhere, including my peripheral vision. And so it's almost like having a macro lens on everything I look at. Incidentally, going into like a Dave and Buster's gives me a mental meltdown because there's too much going on in a place like that. Yeah. You know, with the video games and stuff, it's like, oh no, can't do that. But,
That's interesting. Yeah. It reminded me a bit of conversations around hallucinogenic drugs or magic mushrooms and things like that, and how it can make people see reality in a different way, or perhaps not take it seriously. Oh, sorry, have a bit of irreverence to what we're force fed as this is reality, this is how things work, and perhaps that's why magic mushrooms and LSD is suppressed and illegal, because it actually does the walls of what we think things should be like do crumble a little bit if you get high.
I've never done drugs. Clearly I don't have to get to that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To be honest, I spend a lot of my time making sure I don't. I spend a lot of my time trying to avoid dreamy mental states because it's hard to function in regular life if you're walking around going, I don't know if this street is real.
Of course.
And it can be quite terrifying. So one of the things, I had a professor who was quite hip and rad in the early days. And he was always like, oh, that sounds so cool what you're going through. And I was like, yeah, well, it's not, because...
Not really, yeah.
Well, like one day I stood on my porch in my house and I looked across the way and I saw both the street in front of my house and Shovelin Center, which was part of the campus I was on, and a building that was in another city. And I just sat down. I was like, well, I don't know if there's really a street there. And that's kind of an important thing, you know, for not being hit by a car, to go like, I want to make sure. You know, because if it's that building, if I'm in the city with that other building, then that's a sidewalk. But if I'm in the city, you know, like, then that's a street, and I can't tell the difference. So, So living in reality and functioning in reality, it's not easy when you literally struggle to understand which reality you're walking around in.
So, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe it's quite the opposite of people that want to explore those kind of altered states, right? It's the opposite, because you're like, I don't want that because that's confusing and upsetting.
Well, the other thing too is, okay, if you're going to take a substance to alter, you usually do that knowing it's going to end.
Yes.
Whereas I don't know if at any point I tip off the deep end, if I'm like, how long it'll take me to swim back. So, but I find that, like I said, I don't actually have this condition when I am stress-free, well-rested. It's definitely when pressure is put on my, you know, cerebral processing unit that I start to have episodes. And so, I don't have to be medicated. I was on, they put me on anti-seizure medicine, which helped quite a bit, but I don't have to be on it now. And I don't tend not to have these anymore.
Okay. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, I always know that they're there. It's sort of like having another version of yourself who's just like hanging out in the shadows and going, reality might not be real. And I'm like, shh. Like, I have things to do. I have a job. Yeah. I'm trying to, like, you know, I'm making coffee. Go away. But it makes me very fascinated with the brain. And it's spurred on my research partly into this book, which has to do with where we live in our composite brain bodies, right? You know, exactly where consciousness is, and how it functions, and how much brain you need to have consciousness, and can your brain live outside your body? The answer, weirdly, is yes, proven in 1971. Weirdly, I mean, it sounds like a really long time ago for us to have discovered something that we since haven't really talked about. But yeah, having things happen to you or to your family, or realizing that your way of looking at things and processing things is unique, particularly if you're someone who can then articulate it for other people.
Yes.
It's exciting. It means that I feel like I don't just go on these, you know, explorations to write these books or these papers or articles. I go on them for other people. Like, I want to bring people with me and be like, come on, this is cool. We gotta go walk this path. Yes. And see where it goes.
I love that spirit. That's a good way to approach any kind of research or book writing, I guess. This mm-hmm. your new book is Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, and it's about Dr. Robert White, and it's about it's a history of transplants as well within their body transplants, but different organ transplants, but then eventually building up to.
Transplant the whole thing, yeah.
Centered around, yeah, a body transplant or a head transplant. So it's definitely controversial. And it centers around the character Dr. Robert White, because he was a bit of a trailblazer in that world, right? But mm-hmm. what was it that drew you to him specifically to write a whole book about it? Because, you know, he must have been a fascinating character for people listening that don't know anything about him.
Yeah, he was. He was a very fascinating person. He had kind of these twin drives. You know, he was a surgeon. He was a brain surgeon. He saved people's lives. He, you know, saved children from brain cancer and such like, and gave to charity, and was a good Catholic boy and had 10 children, and was nominated for a Nobel Prize for cooling therapies that we still use today in brain surgeries. Wow. And also for heart transplant and heart surgeries. My dad had to have it used when he had open heart surgery. Was also somebody who in it. Oh, and he was friends with two different popes, which I don't even know how you become friends with one pope, much less more than one. But at the same time, wow, he was someone who perfected a technique of taking heads off of things and putting them somewhere else. And that's a strange thing to want to do in the first place. But partly he was trying to prove, today we do organ transplants, and we also do what are called beating heart donors. And what that means is your brain dead, but they can harvest your organs. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
If we're going to do that, we better be sure we all mean the same thing by brain dead. Right. Cause we like, when are you dead enough that we can take your heart, but you're not actually dead? I mean, it's a weird concept. And I think people don't think about it. We just tick the box and go, yeah, I'll be an organ donor. And we don't think about the fact that we want to be sure about when that is.
Yes.
In this time period, in the 60s, so the first kidney transplant was done in the 50s. And then in the 60s, you have people starting to do things like, let's transplant hearts, but a heart still has to be beating when you take it out and put it somewhere else. So, you know, how do we be sure that this person is dead even though the heart is still beating? Heart is run by your autonomic system, so it can beat even when your brain is offline. So they were like, okay, we have to develop this concept of brain death. Great. Brain death means what to you, Jack? When I say brain death, what do you think?
I would say... it's difficult.
Right?
It's difficult because I was thinking as you were talking just then of somebody in my life that was in a coma for a long time, and they didn't think that he would come out, and he actually defied science and came out, and he couldn't walk, but he regained speech,
right,
and all this. Well, and I thought, like, you know, yeah, if they made a decision to say that he was brain dead then
right, and
that chance would have been taken away, yeah, you know, for him to make the recovery.
Like, how they ultimately, and this is exactly what people were worried about. They were like, how do we know for sure that you'll never recover from that coma?
God,
like,
that
what
so deep
tells us that you're never going to come out? And so there was no checklist, or there was kind of a checklist. There was no single agreed upon checklist or definition. All right. So part of White's question was asking the same question from the other side. What is brain death is what they were asking. And his question was, well, okay, what is brain life? Yeah, you know, how do we know? How do we know when the brain is alive? Because if we know when it's alive, then that might help us understand when it's dead. So they were looking a lot at EEG, which, you know, that's where you hook the brain up and it shows you what it's thinking. It's in little peaks and valleys on a graph paper. And so one of the checklists for brain death was an absence of that, just flatlining, no blips, no, you know, lots of other things. There's also other things on it, reflexes, can't breathe on your own, et cetera, et cetera. But, in fact, brain death was never an issue before we had artificial respiration, because you need your brain to be online to breathe. And so it used to be, if you're brain dead, you just died a few minutes later from suffocation. Mm-hmm. So it was after we developed lung artificial breathing technology that this becomes a problem, right? So this is the question. So then White was like, okay, if brain death is the absence of brain signals, what happens if you have brain signals but nothing else? And he embarks on a quest to isolate a living brain. And what that means, and most of us can imagine a kind of brain floating in space, but getting it out while it's still alive is complicated. So he literally, partly he invents the perfusion or the cooling technique to cool the brain down so it's less greedy for oxygen. And then he ends up abstracting it out of a live monkey while keeping it bathed in blood from a donor monkey.
Wow.
And and so it's like it's hooked up to this other donor monkey's blood supply. It's also being like oxygenated. All this other stuff is happening. It's being fed nutrients. But he gets the entire brain out, cuts it away from its housing.
Oh my God.
And it's still alive and it's hooked up to EEG and it's just a brain. It is a brain on a little stand and it is thinking. It's moving the graph paper. The needles are bouncing. We've got peaks, we've got valleys, and all the places we'd expect to have them. It's still in there.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's quite terrifying. Bizarre.
And also like really upsetting to animal rights people. So this inaugurates a huge fight between White and what would later be known as PETA. And he publicly debated Ingrid Newkirk. I actually talked to her about it. I interviewed her for the book because Dr. White has since passed on, but she's still alive, about those clashes. So, you know, he's done this and he basically said to everybody, see, this is brain life. So we know if there's peaks and valleys, that's life. And if there's not peaks and valleys, that's death. But a lot of his colleagues were just kind of like, okay, that's cool and everything, but we don't think that's life. We don't think those peaks and valleys mean that monkey is still a monkey in there being monkey.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought they'd have the opposite. I thought like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, because they were like,
he's proved what he wanted. He kind of proved what he wanted to prove, right?
That, well, he thought, but they didn't buy it, basically. So that is why he looked at doing a body/head transplant. And it's called both. He calls it a head transplant when he's working on monkeys. And when he talks about it as a potential life-saving procedure for humans, he calls it a body transplant. So it's a little rhetorical, interestingly rhetorical sidestep that he does there.
Yeah. I understand.
But, yeah. But he decides to transplant a monkey's entire head onto another monkey's body. And this is something similar had been done in Russia with dogs. In that case, they left the head on the dog and they just sewed another head onto it, and it survived for a little while. Take monkey A's head off its body, and we're going to put monkey B's head on monkey A's body. And that's what he does. And he does it because he wants the head to wake up so he can prove, see, that EEG of the brain without its body is right. Cause this is a head. It's still just a head. It's a head being fed by the blood of another body, but
he wasn't expecting the head to control the body, right? Cause if you sever the spinal cord and the all the nerves, and it'd just be like on
it's really just on a life support system that happens to be another monkey's body.
So it's more like proving the point, like you said.
Yeah. He wanted to prove that, like, okay, they didn't believe me when I said the brain without a body is still alive if it's producing EEG. So I will produce an entire head so you can see it wake up. So it wakes up, it looks around, it tries to bite Dr. White. You know, they feed it, they give it water. It blinks. It can't make noise because they happened to have where they cut it meant there was no voice box, so it couldn't make noise. But it tried to, and it gnashed its teeth. It was clearly upset, but it was also proving itself to be still a monkey. You know, still in there.
So yeah, it'd be like becoming paralyzed overnight, right? Like, I mean, I don't even know what it'd be like, actually.
But it inaugurates a whole bunch of other questions. Like, if your head's on another body, are you still you? Because your body's actually a big, important part. This is why I say I become interested in questions of where consciousness is. And that's the philosophical part, right? Is I don't know that I'm just my brain. There's neurons in my gut. We're learning that we're not quite like octopi, right? Octopi literally have brains in their arms. But we're learning that there are neurons, and that the nervous system, the whole neurological apparatus, is hugely important to how the brain functions in the first place. So how you receive signals is part of who you are, and how hormones interact with your brain, and the chemicals your body releases. And if you're suddenly on a different, maybe if you're not on a body at all, right? If you're just in a box or something. But if you're on another body, you're getting those signals. You know, even if you can't move that body, those chemicals and those neurons, and, you know, so are you still the same person? Now, that's not the question Dr. White was asking. He was saying, can the brain outlive its body, proving brain life, right? And they do ultimately come to a conclusion about brain death, but it's a legal definition. It's not a medical definition. We still don't have a medical, quote unquote, medical definition of death. We have legal definitions that are used by medicine. And that means they're not all the same. They're different from country to country. I know when I wrote Death Summer Coat, which was an earlier book about death and dying, I've discovered that you could be declared alive in one country and declared dead in another. Like, if you had dual citizenship, you could be both alive and dead at the same time. Very, you know, Schrodinger's. Schrodinger's brain death. Yeah. So it's, you can understand why these are sideways questions. These are questions that are on the edges, and these are questions that largely are not asked. And so take someone like me, who's a bit, you know, peculiar herself, to, I think, look sideways and go, but what about this question over here? You know, what about this? Yeah. It is mind blowing. We just don't think about the other side of these things. And every time I have one of these conversations, I have people go, oh, I had never thought about it that way. And I'm like, I know, right? one.
But then Rob, to go back to Robert White, he then, I mean, if you naturally move from dogs to monkeys, that would lead you to believe he was moving towards the idea of a human body transplant. And he didn't get to do that, right?
He was absolutely aiming for one. So I the book, if you guys are interested in the Cold War and the space race, this book is a parallel story. It's an inner space race. And we're racing against the Soviet Union in a lot of these ways. And so we went, right? Dogs in space, monkeys in space, humans in space.
Yes.
Dog head transplant, monkey head transplant. White did want to perform a human head transplant. And he developed protocols, diagrams. He even practiced. So this is quite common. Even the first kidney transplant, the first practice was done on cadavers. They practiced the surgery on cadavers.
Yes, of course.
And so Dr. White actually performed a human head transplant on cadavers in preparation mm-hmm. for doing it on living human beings. And he was ready to go. But you need a couple of things to work out for you if you want to perform a head transplant on a human being. Four things. You need somebody who's willing to let you transplant their head.
While you're alive.
While you're alive. You need a donor body. A donor body that's a beating heart donor, right? Back to that brain death whole problem. Mm-hmm. You need the money, and you need a place that will allow you to do the surgery. So I imagine most of us think that the hardest thing to get would be somebody willing to let you take their head off. Strangely, that's the first thing he managed to get. So Craig Vidovitz, who was a tetraplegic person, he'd been injured in a diving accident as a kid. He was happily, you know, he's married, had kids, had a good life, owned a business, but his organs had begun to fail. And here's the sort of irony of all this is being tetraplegic made it difficult for him to be considered a candidate for organ transplant. So, you know, failing other options, he offered himself to Dr. White for a full body transplant. So he had to volunteer.
But he would know that the body wouldn't work, right?
Body didn't work then. He was tetraplegic
already. Oh, so it's just to aid the scientific pursuit.
Well, it's mainly because his organs were shutting down, and so he wanted a new body extend his life, you know.
Yeah.
Also, because he was interested in the science, he himself was an inventor and was, you know, a pioneer in his own right.
Okay.
A pretty neat guy, actually, and very brassy. He was nice. Very, very angry about the way he was, you know, he said, why am I not a good candidate, right, for an organ transplant? It's like you're saying my life isn't worth as much as an able-bodied person's life, and that's not true. Mm. So it was an ableism argument as well. So anyway, he volunteers himself. White also has access to the donor bodies. He worked at a trauma hospital. You see a lot of that. Particularly motorcycle accident victims and things like that who right. are brain dead, but their bodies are still functioning. What he didn't get was, first of all, this surgery, I mean, the bare minimum cost would be $4 million. And it was probably going to be much, much higher than that. Secondly, you need a hospital to give you permission to do it. There's not necessarily an overarching body that says we're making this illegal or anything, but you have to have a hospital going, yeah, we'll let you try this here.
Yeah.
And then, you know, be ready for whatever the fallout is. If it goes horribly wrong, you're on the hook for that. And PR is kind of a big deal when you're trying to save people's lives and you mm-hmm. allow somebody to go and do something like this, right? You're taking a risk. It's a big risk. And in fact, even the first kidney transplant at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital, some of Joseph Murray's colleagues were like, I don't know, man, you know, this is risky. If this goes horribly wrong, you may shut down organ transplant altogether and you may put a black mark against our hospital. So it's risky. Right.
Yeah.
So he didn't get those final two pieces, the money and the permission to do the human head transplant, but he felt that it was possible and in fact thought it would be easier than the monkey head transplant. The monkey had lived for 9 days. They didn't give it the immune suppressant drugs. So eventually, you know, you have to take immunosuppressant drugs or else the other things will fail.
Because it rejects the new organ or whatever it is.
No, honestly, I'm not sure. Like at that point, I'm like, is the body rejecting the head? Is the head rejecting the body? It's kind of hard to tell exactly right? That's complicated in itself. But
could you keep a body? Of course, you can keep a body alive without a brain, right?
You can, but not indefinitely. It's a really interesting question, but you know, I know it seems like we just gave you a spoiler, but actually the book is really about so much more than that. The book is a 50-year history of very strange things that science and medicine were doing during the Cold War and after it. And it's not the end. There are still people trying to perform human head transplants.
Wow. Where? Do we know these people?
We know who they are. We don't know where because they're not going to tell us so far they're doing it sort of on the... on the download, some of their it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't actually happened yet. It was scheduled, but the patient backed out. Sergio Canavero is an Italian doctor who is trying to perform one, and he works a lot with a Chinese doctor named Dr. Ren. And he had a patient who was from Russia suffering from a muscular degenerative condition who was willing to undergo a head transplant, but he fell in love and got married and said, you know, this surgery is, my life is going to end anyway, but I don't want it to end in surgery.
Okay.
So he backed out of it. And so one hasn't happened yet, but my point, and the book talks about this, the book also talks about what the next steps might be in other ways, yeah. For instance, solving the problem of paralysis and questions about souls and brains and personalities and consciousness. And so, yeah, it's, the book is big. There's a lot going on in there. It's funny. Come for the head transplant, stay for everything else.
I hear you. When you were talking about self and I guess the soul and who we truly are, which is all the kind of philosophical side of it, it does remind me of, I watched, do you know the School of Life? Do you know this, YouTube series channel? Mm-hmm. Kind
no,
of thing?
I don't.
It's like a modern philosophy kind of, they make little animations and it's really interesting. They pose a lot of the questions around self and how to live a spiritual life without being religious. That's the big thing of theirs. Mm-hmm. But they talk about, there's one video that really stuck with me about, like, if we lose our limb, are we still us? If we lose our legs, are we still us?
Yeah.
If we, mm-hmm. like, our body grows from a tiny baby to a big body, and then it shrinks a little bit when you get a bit older and you hunch over. And so our body changes and the cells are constantly dying and kind of renewing themselves, and everything in your body is kind of, ever changing throughout your whole life. So the video addresses that, like, so who really are we? And is it our memories even? Like, you think your memories are a really big part of who you are, but then sometimes you lose your memories, for certain reasons or over time. And then are you still you? What makes us us? And they kind of argue in that video that it's like a character. Our character, that's how they describe it. It's our approach to life, our values. Because it was kind of like, they quote a philosopher who I think it was a philosopher who said, would you rather have all of your memories, but your values are changed indefinitely, your values mm-hmm. and your outlook, or would you rather have your values and outlook intact and lose all your memories?
You know,
he argued that most people would say, I'd prefer my values and my outlook and my approach to life intact. And if I lose my memories, so be it. So I guess that really made me think about identity and who we really are. But if we're not as attached to our physical bodies as first thought, like I said, we're a baby, then we're an adult, and then our body changes, we might become, we might lose the use of our limbs in certain situations. Then if we're not connected, identity isn't merged with our physical body perfectly, then when we die, maybe when our physical body dies, maybe we don't die. I mean, that's the question that they pose.
there's an interesting book called Thinking Outside the Body, or Thinking Beyond the... Oh, I've forgotten the title of it. It's a really interesting one. It's talking about how even our thoughts are externalized in some ways, particularly in the digital space. Mm-hmm. Think about predictive text and the way you use it. Think about the way machines help us learn and communicate and do other things. So it's an interesting thing to look at. But another, let me put this backwards because, why not? Mm-hmm. We talk about it as, maybe the mind isn't as attached to the body as what you were saying, but maybe the body isn't as attached to the mind. It's possible that losing the loss of your limbs or the loss of the use of your limbs is not the same thing as no longer being attached to your body. You now are a person with the memory of body and the ghost of body. And I don't just mean in terms of phantom limb. I mean, you are a person whose body has changed, and that change is now part of who you are as a person. It's not as though you were born without limbs. You were someone who had limbs and then lost them. You are now a person who has lost their limbs. And that's a deep, integral part of who you are as a person and how you interact with the world. So
yes.
I actually think that self is embodied. I think that, I think particularly looking at the LGBTQ movement can help us kind of think that through a little bit. One of the things that we've learned about trans identity is that how your physical body looks and interacts with the world and the way you understand your gender or genders or the lack of genders is a something that like deeply affects your identity, your health, your psychological status, your mental health, your all these other things. So, you know, we're not just brains on legs, though I think some of us might be more brains on legs than others. I'm not particularly, I feel like I just drive this body around like a vehicle. But again, I'm kind of a neurologically interesting individual. And my processing is a little bit different. I'm probably somewhere on the autism spectrum, you know, to be, if we're being perfectly honest, though untested. And that's not uncommon that certain kinds of processing are less embodied than others. But I think to suggest that all humans are brains on legs is a real disservice to lived experience by, you know, lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. Even Stephen Hawking at one point was asked, like, well, wouldn't you rather not have your disability? And I'm you know, massively truncating his response, but basically he's like, but this is who I am. And bodies are messy and, you know, a pain to deal with, and I don't have to really think about mine. So, you know, he's like, bodies have needs. you know, and of course I might think, well, gosh, your body has all kinds of needs because it has to be mitigated in all these ways. But for him, it was like that his body got to be a secondary consideration. That was nonetheless part of his embodied experience. So I think as much as I love the idea of Cartesian dualism, I'm definitely someone for whom I don't think those divisions are easy. And I think they might not be in the places we expect.
Right. Yeah, I understand. Interesting that you mentioned the LGBTQ community in relation to your research and your book, because that is something I thought about speaking to a trans friend of mine. He talked a lot about his identity in relation to his gender and his physical body, because he transitioned from a woman to a girl to a man. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking it's definitely from a point perspective of privilege, because I'm cisgendered and I'm male. I thought I never really think about my physical my identity as much as he has talked to me about in depth. He talked in depth about his physical identity being really important to his identity, who he really was, and talked about, you know, operations that he was looking to get and things like that. And I thought I very rarely think about, you know, very rarely think, oh, you know, I'm a man, this is who I am, I'm a male, this defines me, my body defines me. Maybe that's it comes from a point of privilege, or maybe it's just I'm more of a brain on a brain on a body, maybe. I don't know what it is, but I remember thinking I've never thought about identity as much as when I speak to him, you know.
Yeah, well,
in regards to my physical body, you know.
Right, well, and I think it matters too about what kind of the whole point is that it's massively different for each individual person. And so I think the big prescriptive thing saying, well, we'll all be better off as brains in boxes is like, eh. You know, we're not all built and put together. That's not part of the beauty of it, right? Is that we're not all built and put together the same way. But that's also what makes studying the brain and body connections endlessly fascinating, because you're never going to get to the answer. There is no the answer.
Yes.
Right. And that tends to be the kind of stuff that fascinates me. And I will say this, my books are never answers. My books are introductions to really good questions.
Nice. Yeah. And I wanted to talk about why we know each other, or why we've met each other, which is you emailed me because you were, can you talk about this, the cloning?
Yeah, I'm someone who's really interested in human reproduction. Nice. And I do mean that partly in the traditional sense. I was a historian. My dissertation even looked at birth, history of birth, and how we all sort of still get here pretty much the same way. You know, you're either, we have cesarean section, there's some other things, but generally speaking, birth hasn't changed all that much until very, very recently. So like the first, I'm fascinated with the story of quote unquote test tube babies, right? The first in vitro fertilization and the way that, at the time was considered pure science fiction, and people were terrified of it and they thought they wouldn't develop normally. And of course now I forget what the stats are amazing, right? It's a ridiculously high number of people have been born this way. And now of course they're just humans. So in the process of studying that and research into stem cell therapy and gene therapy and other things, I came across human cloning. And we do practice human cloning today. It's just that we do therapeutic human cloning, right? Pluripoint stem cells are technically cloned, but they're not, it's not reproductive cloning. It's not, we made a clone of ourselves and we put it in a womb and we grew it up, but we are doing that with animals. The Prowalski horse, the black-footed ferret, they're trying to save endangered species by actual reproductive cloning.
Wow.
And I got to, you know, yeah, it's very successful, actually. The Prowalski horse from conception, I mean, conception as an idea, yeah, to birth was a year. I mean, they can do this really quickly and really efficiently. That's a Revive and Restore is the company that is sort of spearheading that with a couple of universities and labs and zoos. So, you know, we're doing this with animals. We're doing certain versions of human cloning with cells at the cellular level, but we're not doing reproductive cloning with humans, unless you count the three-person babies, which is, that's quite new. That's where they are using nuclear transfer at the egg and DNA sort of level, mitochondrial DNA level, to use three different parents to create a child in situations where someone carries a bad, some sort of genetic predisposition to having children that will not survive.
Okay.
So
okay.
Again, so anyway, I know all of that stuff. And suddenly I had to ask myself the question, why aren't we using reproductive cloning in humans? I mean, I think it's an ethic. What I realize is that it's probably not a scientific why. It's an ethics why.
Yes.
We no doubt have the technology to produce human clones, but we ethically have decided not to. And so I was fascinated by that question, and I kind of went down a rabbit hole asking, why haven't we, or have we? Yeah. I've now met someone named Dr. Zavos, who has claimed to have implanted cloned embryos in human women, but not brought any of them to term. You know, and I,
wow.
Yes, right. Yeah. They just keep failing. They miscarry, but that doesn't mean that it isn't possible. It just means it hasn't happened yet. And he got into quite a bit of trouble. I think he ended up, he can be somewhat controversial, but he still runs an andrology clinic and still does a lot of work in the field. There's Brigitte Boislier, and she's MAID now. And I met Brigitte, through you. I met you, and I got in touch with some of the folks at, ClonAid, or well, it's not ClonAid anymore, but StemAid. And, you know, she's been great about talking about the things that did or didn't work in history. And so it still fascinates me. I still feel like there's writing to be done on that subject, but it interests me for the same reason that head transplants do. We don't do them, not because we can't, but because we've decided we shouldn't.
Yes, exactly. And just to give a bit of background of why Brigitte links to me is because she's part of a religion called the Raelians, the Raelism religion, which I wrote about, I think it was last year. And they, long story short, they believe that our Earth was seeded by advanced humans long ago, and we're actually, our ancestors are really advanced humans that live elsewhere in the universe, and they've put us onto the Earth as a kind of experiment so that we can scientifically and technologically advance enough so they can come back and take us or rescue us or whatever will happen then. And they kind of reframe or reimagine, I guess, a lot of spiritual, a lot of religious texts and books to say, hey, you know, it wasn't angels in the Bible, it was aliens.
Right.
Or the Elohim, which they say is a plural word, which is a plural word, but they think it means the advanced human aliens, mm-hmm, rather than the angels in the Bible.
And it's fascinating to me because, of course, the minute you say, it's sort of like when people say the government is now interested in UFOs, and people don't realize that UFO doesn't equal little green men. It means an unidentified object, and alien doesn't equal little green men either. It equals things we're not really clear on. It's interesting to me how in many circles you have people going, yeah, I could see that there might be life forms outside the universe. I could see that there might be ways, but then the minute you use the word alien, everybody goes, you know, your mind literally jumps to, what was it? Mars Attacks, right? Like, laser gun. Looney Tunes kind of figures.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do find that kind of interesting, and it's funny because I did find out that she was Aurelian, and I did some research. I ended up running into an academic who wrote quite extensively about the religion, and it was through reading her books I realized, oh wow, like the kind of clickbait headlines are not they tend to take that Mars Attacks.
Yeah,
route,
yeah, of course. People find it hard to understand anything complex. I think is that if it's emotional and it's simplified, it gets shared like wildfire online. So I think it's a way more complex and a deeper religion. Yeah,
Susan J. Palmer. She's at. I'm trying to remember which. I think she's at Dawson in Montreal and Quebec, Dawson College, and she's the one who wrote the academic book about, you know, Raelians and what their kind of beliefs are. But what was most interesting to me is it's actually quite secular. It's almost it's like a religion, but it's a kind of godless one, right? It's mm-hmm. kind of got a sense that it's kind of worship science to a degree. It's like science is the solution to everything. And so it doesn't surprise me that they are also interested in some of the more, you know, edgy areas of science, because if you're willing to push the boundaries. I mean, I just did a what's stranger, someone who believes in potentially the seeded planet looking at cloning, or somebody who is Catholic doing head transplants. I've kind of been down this road before, I think it's worth looking at.
To explain a bit more, the religion, so people from the Raelism religion, they started something called Clone Aid, where they were self-funding research into human cloning. And obviously they attracted a lot of controversy, but even more when Bridget came out and she said, we've cloned a human. That was in the early 2000s. And she said, we've cloned somebody. And it was, you know, obviously it was all over the place.
All over the news for a while,
Crazy cult claims that they've cloned somebody. And when I spoke to, so I spent a lot of time with them, and I, you know, I consider a few of them friends of mine now. And one of which is Glenn, who Glenn's the leader of the UK division, I guess. And he did a lot of the TV interviews at the time, kind of debating whether cloning was ethical and whether they should have done it. And do you know what I asked him after a really long conversation? I said, did you guys, how it transpired was that they didn't have any proof, or they chose to back out at the last minute and said, no,
they didn't provide any. No. Uh-huh.
Exactly. So I said to him, did you, you know, off the record, did you guys clone somebody? And he said, I honestly don't know, but it's beside the point. The debate is still valid. Yeah. And I'm glad I, you know, went on TV to defend it, because stem cell research is exactly the same, and it's just been given a different name. And it's kind of like this kind of person who does stem cell research is totally fine, but then these weirdos who try human cloning, they're immoral and dangerous.
And Brigitte and Clone Aid, they weren't the only ones. That's what I discovered, is that there's actually like five other groups that were experimenting. In my research, what I've discovered is that there was actually quite a lot of people who had cloned embryos. They just, and some of them had even implanted them, but none of them had been brought to term. So this is also true in IVF therapy. It doesn't always work. And my sister-in-law, she went through all kinds of, you know, hell, basically, trying to conceive her twin boys, and you know the amount of times that things don't work and they don't happen, and you try again, and it's expensive each time. And so partly what I was interested in writing about was the IVF movement in general, and then a look at this somewhat more specifically, that in cases where you can't get it to work, is it permissible, is it ethical, mm-hmm. or is it unethical? You know, they thought that that in vitro fertilization was described as unethical originally, and the funding was pulled. So now, you know, are we at a place where it's time to re-examine that from a couple different scientific perspectives? I find it fascinating. So I've been doing quite a bit of research into it and into stem cells generally, because I think that there's a lot going on with stem cells that simply isn't accessible to the average person. Like you can read the papers, but you're probably not going to get a lot out of them. And so partly what I think my job is as someone who studies these things and has worked in the public sector, is as a translator. I like to translate science for a general audience so that people can kind of, you don't want to abdicate the responsibility of medical ethics to other people. You know what I mean? You want to be part of those decisions, and you can't be part of those decisions if you're not well informed, and you can't be well informed if you can't, you know, accessibly read and understand the science. So, part of my job is, I'm an editor of a medical humanities journal for BMJ, and it's the same kind of thing, that there's a social justice angle to communicating clearly to the public and giving people a sense of what science is up to so that we can help determine. I think most people feel like it's actually a great thing that we can save endangered species through cloning. If we translate that to human beings, what are the ethical, you know, what are the cans and what are the shoulds? And sometimes we get to the cans before we get to the shoulds, and that ethical component
needs
to be there, you know, because if you're just going to go, yeah, sure, science, go ahead, push away, then you might okay something that leads to catastrophe down the road, because we have a tendency not to have very far sight into these things. And I love Paul Virilio, a French theorist of accidents, used to always say that when we invented the plane, we also invented the plane crash. You know, we have to think about the fact that our technologies come with their own catastrophes.
Interesting. That's interesting. It's a bit like a freight train sometimes, I think. Technology and I guess some elements of medicine and healthcare, I guess. It's like you said, the cans come before the shoulds. Like, you know,
right,
we can't wait. Like, I'm really curious. You spoke to Brigitte, is that right? You spoke to Brigitte. And what did she say, or what did you ask her about the cloning
thing? Oh, well, it was a very interesting conversation, and hopefully I'll publish something about it, and you guys can read it.
I'm fascinated. What do you think personally? Because if you're anything like me, I go into these big research holes, and I go in with one thing in mind sometimes. And
so I'll leave you with I'll leave you today with an answer that works for almost all my books, which is most of the time I discover that the reality is far stranger than our assumptions about the reality, that our truths and facts are far weirder than the fictions we create. And that, you know, our limitations really can't be driven simply by our technical limitations, because the technical limitations aren't very limited and they keep changing, and we keep being able to push those boundaries. So you have to learn the policing before it's too late, before you actually outstrip your ability. You know, it's a bit of a Pandora's box situation. Once you've learned how to do something, it's pretty hard to put it back in the box.
Yes.
So I'll leave with that. And I'm really glad I got to be on your show today.
I'm really happy. I'm happy you came on. I've got so many things flying around in my head now. So I'm really happy you came on. You've opened some really important questions, and it's just being nice to talk to you again.
Yes, thank you. And for your listeners, the Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher will be out in the UK next week, I think. So you can pre-order it now, and it should be coming out soon. And I look forward to hearing what people think about it.
Yeah, great. I'll put all the links in the description and everything. Thank you so much, Brandy.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. I really want to hear your thoughts on this, because, you know, I feel like I could have talked to Brandy for hours and hours. So every time she answered a question, I had about 10 more questions coming up. So I'm sure you guys had questions as well. So yeah, send them over or get in touch in whatever way you can on social media, and let me know what you thought of it. Her book's coming out next week, I think, in the UK. Her book is called Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher, A Monkey's Head, The Pope's Neuroscientist, and The Quest to Transplant the Soul. So that's what the book's called. And If you like what you heard on the podcast, I'm sure you're going to love the book as well. If this is your first time listening to the Human Magic Podcast, like I said, this is the 16th episode. If you're interested in this kind of, I don't know, philosophical kind of areas, I've done stuff about, I've done an episode about Satanism where I spoke to the head of a Satanist global order. I also did one about Islam and climate change, Christianity and Christian assimilation in Africa. And I've done loads of different ones, sex work and BDSM. So if any of those sound interesting to you and yeah, you want to delve a little bit deeper, go back and have a listen to some. There's 15 others to choose from. So you might find something you enjoy. Again, thanks for everyone that donates and listens. And yeah, just stay blessed, stay hydrated. Here in London, it is very hot and toasty. I'm not complaining. I'm just stating it. And therefore, I'm trying to keep hydrated. That's my number one priority at the minute. So I recommend you do the same wherever you are in the world, whatever the weather. Drink plenty of water. Get a good night's sleep if you can. Drink plenty of water. Did I say drink plenty of water? Stay hydrated. Cheers.